You're listening to the Diplomats podcast on Asian geopolitics. I'm your host, as always, Ankit Panda, and I'm joined today by my co-host, Prashant Parameswaran, an editor at The Diplomat. And we're also joined by our colleague, Franz Stefan Gadi, who covers defense issues in Asia. Thanks a lot for joining me today, guys. Today's episode is devoted primarily to Australia, which recently announced the award of the biggest defense deal in its history to a French consortium, DCNS, to build a replacement for its Collins-class submarines. The deal, which will come in at about 50 billion Australian dollars, will be for the construction of 12 new conventionally powered submarines to be built in Adelaide, South Australia, which is where Malcolm Turnbull, the Prime Minister, flanked by his Defence Minister Maurice Payne, announced the deal earlier this week. Now, DCNS is offering to Australia as the short-fin Barracuda-class submarine, an as-yet undeveloped model that is a conventional variant of France's nuclear-powered Barracuda-class submarines. Due to political considerations, a nuclear propulsion attack sub, an SSN, was a non-starter in Australia. And we also don't know too much about the physical and technical aspects of the submarine, but DCNS has said that the physical dimensions are essentially a hull length of 90 meters and a submerged displacement of 4,000 tons. DCNS is a pretty experienced sub-builder. They've built over 100 boats for 9 different navies. The so-called Collins-class replacement project, known by the Australian government as the SEA 1000 tender, has been long a topic of speculation and discussion in the Australian media and abroad alike. Indeed, Franz, Prashant, and I have written about this several times at The Diplomat over the past year or so. And I'm really glad to do this podcast finally with the announcement of the deal and kind of go over some of the reasons that DCNS triumphed and the other bidders didn't. Now, there's really two parts to this conversation, and we will essentially split the podcast into two halves. First, I want to make the most of having Franz on the podcast today and dig into the technical and domestic political reasons in Australia that DCNS triumphed where Germany and Japan, the other bidders, failed. After that, we'll talk a bit more broadly about Australia's regional policy, its naval aspirations, and the strategic effects of this submarine deal on the Australia-Japan bilateral relationship. So with that, Franz, you and I both wrote about this deal last week, and you actually had a really interesting take about why France triumphed where Germany's Type 216 and Japan's Soryu bids failed. So the Soryu in particular was long seen as the favorite to win out in this tripartite contest, at least when Tony Abbott was still the prime minister in Australia. Even the United States, an important ally for both countries, wanted to see the Soryu prevail because of the positive effects for trilateral cooperation and bilateral Australia-Japan strategic ties. So with that, Franz, what was it about DCNS's short fin Barracuda offering that you think led to it beating out the other competitors in Australia?
First off, I just would like to say that it is important to understand that this week's announcement was a statement in principle over the purchase of French submarines and did not include the signing of a contract. A 3-year submarine design contract is only expected to be concluded at the end of this year, perhaps, or early 2017. And I think the next month will be crucial in figuring out the particulars, including detailed technical specifications, construction schedules, technology transfer agreements, and what parts of the sub will in fact be built in Australia. And because, remember, France and all the other bidders only had to present a pre-concept design to meet Australian capabilities and did not have a fully designed and developed submarine that they were offering, as you, Ankit, pointed out already in the introduction, I believe. And the requirements outlined in the bid were a 4,000-ton displacement, a range and endurance similar to the Collins-class submarines, and then sensor performance and stealth abilities better than the Collins, and perhaps most importantly, a U.S. combat system. And France appears to have fulfilled or be able to fulfill all of those requirements. Arguably, I think the two most critical aspects next to the U.S. combat system in the selection process were range and high endurance. That is, how long can the submarine be at sea, and will it have enough room to accommodate enough sailors to fulfill all the tasks required on board? Now, I think that if we look at the bid, I think the reason why Japan lost to France essentially is due to five main points as I have written this week in my piece for our website. I think, first of all, France heavily betted on the close relationship between Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe and former Australian Prime Minister Tony Abbott, who allegedly, we're not sure, promised Tokyo a deal in which the submarines would be domestically constructed in Japan and not Australia. Yet once Abbott was ousted from power, Japan was merely one of three bidders next to Germany and France, and did no longer receive the political support it was accustomed to from the new government. And I think because of that, it had to revamp its strategy to win the bid. And I think Japanese defense industry representatives were simply outmaneuvered by their French and German counterparts. Also, I think picking France over Japan is also politically more opportune for the Australian government at this stage. Australians are likely to head to the polls on July 2nd in federal elections. And France promised that 12 submarines, all the 12 submarines, will be built in South Australia, and that this will create more than 2,800 new jobs. And South Australia has been suffering from deindustrialization, and I think the last auto plant will actually shut down at the end of this year. Also, I think it's important to point out that Japan was initially reluctant to build the submarines in Australia, given Tokyo's general reluctance to transfer sensitive military technology abroad. And although that changed somewhat toward the end of the bidding process. Also, Japan's defense industry was not enthusiastic about selling its submarines overseas. The two companies producing the submarines, Mitsubishi and Kawasaki, currently have only the capacity to meet the domestic demand for the Japanese Maritime Self-Defense Force. And in addition, there was also a concern that the powerful Japanese bureaucracy could derail the deal, and also that even if they would sign the contract, that there would be a clash of work cultures, given that Japan has not really built anything overseas, well, essentially never actually has built military hardware overseas since the beginning of modern defense industry in Japan. And fourth, and I think that's also a very important point, is that the United States has tacitly been supporting the Japanese bid, but recently signaled Australia that its opposition to a potential European submarine supplier has dropped. And this is probably one of the most important aspects in this whole story, why France was eventually chosen. Because Australia always wanted a US combat system aboard its submarine. And combat systems are sort of like the brain of a submarine around which everything else is built. Thus, the importance of the US agreeing to work with France cannot be overemphasized here. And my last point is that I think while it is very difficult to assess any submarine bid on an unclassified level, there's a fair argument to be made that the new Barracuda class better meets Australia's needs than the Japanese stealth submarines. As I already outlined above, although it remains to be seen, as you mentioned it before, Ankit, how difficult it will be to swap from a nuclear power to a conventional propulsion system, given that the new Barracuda class is based off a French nuclear attack submarine design.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like the big lesson here is that defense deals of this magnitude are never entirely about technology. There's always domestic concerns, strategic concerns that are affecting how governments make these decisions. Also, Franz, I was wondering on the technical side of things, it's interesting how the two offerings that lost, the Soryu and the Type 216, actually involved an expansion of the hull of previous designs. The Soryu would have been expanded to accommodate the additional sailors that Australia required, and Australia has had some negative experiences with domestic shipbuilding and dealing with hull modifications, particularly with its own Collins class. So I think they were just eager to avoid that this time around. And it seems like the Barracuda, as you correctly said, The key issue seems to be the change in the propulsion system, but that seems to be a more manageable engineering task for the Australians.
Right.
And the story, you also had the additional problem of the lithium-ion batteries, which are generally considered unsafe. There have been some fires on the Boeing Dreamliner aircraft that use lithium-ion batteries, and if I were a submariner, I don't know if I'd feel too comfortable with a lithium-ion propulsion system.
Well, although I would say that by the time that Australia would have received the first submarine, Japan would have had more than a decade to trial and test those ion those batteries out. So I do think that you can make a good argument that those sorts of batteries would have been relatively safe by the time Australia received them for their submarine fleet. What you were saying also about, I think it's important to understand that size really matters for the Australian requirements, as I outlined before. And it's not so much even the systems that are installed aboard the submarines, it's also how many sailors a submarine can accommodate. And obviously, that's one of the principal reasons why the French design was chosen over the Japanese design. Curiously enough, I read that one of the problems when they were looking at the bid was that Australian sailors are generally a bit taller than Japanese sailor. Therefore, they just did not feel very comfortable choosing the Japanese design because of the size. And also, I think it's important when you talk about endurance, it's not only the propulsion system and the technology, it's also that you have can accommodate enough people aboard to fulfill all the different tasks required. On a long-range submarine patrol, and I think that's only possible if you have enough people aboard.
Right. So great. I want to move this conversation now to the second part, which is, less about the technology and more about how Australia plans to use it, and also the broader interesting strategic question about just how much of a setback this will be for the Australia-Japan bilateral relationship. And Prashant, this is where, I was hoping that you'd be able to, provide some context as well. So Australia has recently released a white paper outlining its broader plans for its navy among its armed forces more generally. So how will these submarines sort of play into that strategy? And I guess, what is that strategy more broadly?
Yeah, so I think so. Before that, let me just say a little bit about the point that you mentioned, Ankit, which is that it's really important, and I think France also mentioned this in his piece, that in these submarine decisions, particularly this one, which is the largest defense acquisition in Australian history, it's not only the technological and commercial issues that matter, but it's also a lot of the political decisions. And I think in this case, Abbott's departure definitely removed the personal commitment that Australia had to Japan's participation in this program. And the domestic political preoccupations for Turnbull with the upcoming election that France talked about were always going to outweigh sort of the broader strategic and commercial and technological considerations. And I think one important point that Franz mentioned in his piece, and he mentioned earlier in the podcast, is that Japan had made several assurances to Australia that it was going to make a concerted effort to address many of the concerns technologically and commercially with the submarines. And there were actually conversations between the Australians and the Japanese about this consistently. So this is definitely something where, politics has mattered definitely much more than the commercial and the technological considerations. But to your point about the Australian naval strategy and the white paper, the latest white paper, and we've had a number of individuals chime in on this for The Diplomat with some very good pieces, it paints a very grim picture of the Asia Pacific, one which has several threats that Australia has to confront. Including terrorism, cyber war, but particularly for the naval context, it's about the rapid military modernization and rivalry among countries in the Asia Pacific, chiefly China, and much of which has been manifested in the East China Sea and the South China Sea, which are pretty close to Australia. And beyond Australia's own defense, the white paper also specifies that Australia should be committed to working with the United States and other like-minded partners in the Asia Pacific to maintain what is called the rules-based order, which actually gets significant attention in that document. So that's where sort of the submarines come in. The white paper contains some specific capabilities for each of Australia's services, but within the Navy, this capability upgrade is by far the biggest, which is not surprising because, as I said earlier, it's the largest single defense investment in Australian history. But there are also other acquisitions involving frigates, patrol boats, amphibious ships, that will not only increase Australia's ability to defend itself, but, as I mentioned earlier, play a growing regional role in the Asia Pacific. I think that's definitely going to be very important moving forward. And I think that sort of takes me to the other point that I wanted to emphasize, which is that it's also important to look at the degree to which, and there's been a lot of conversation about this, to what extent is this a setback for Australia's regional relations? So not just Australia's relations with Japan, but also its relationship with the United States and some of the other countries in the Asia Pacific. And I think if you talk to officials on both sides, this is clearly a setback not only for Australia's relations with Japan, but also the growing convergence that had been occurring between these two U.S. treaty allies, as well as Washington. And that has significance not only for their relationship, but also trilateral and even quadrilateral engagements between these countries. To the submarine issue more specifically, it would have been the first time that all three governments would be working on a single long-term defense project, which is important to emphasize because, as Franz mentioned earlier, this is a capability that Australia would only get into the 2030s. And that means more submarine cooperation between US, Japan, and Australia, more integration in terms of anti-submarine warfare capabilities, and that's important in the context of growing maritime security challenges, including the shared concern that these countries have on China. So when you look at the Australia defense relationship, and this is the point that I think sometimes gets lost, it's also important to emphasize that it's much more than just this submarine deal, as much as it is a setback for cooperation. Australia-Japan defense relations have been on the rise since the 1990s, and it's the product not of, transactions, but converging interests and values, including, as I mentioned earlier, a shared concern about China, but also democracy, rule of law, free markets. And this is something that both sides have emphasized repeatedly in statements, defense documents, and so on and so forth. So my own view is that while this is a lost opportunity, definitely for both sides, it's one where the losses are quite reversible if both governments commit to limiting the damage of that and getting relations back on track.
Yeah, that's definitely a really valid point. I mean, I feel like when we talk about Australia-Japan relationship, the Australia-Japan bilateral over the past few months, there's been a lot of emphasis about this sub deal. But if you look back at the 2+2 meeting, for example, that happened last November between the Australian Foreign and Defence Ministers, you saw that both countries have a very forward-looking and broad bilateral agenda that really isn't mired down in this transaction. It is a part, obviously, of what Japan wanted to see, and no doubt Shinzo Abe is disappointed that this fell through. But I completely, see eye to eye with you on that. That this is a minor setback, and essentially they'll be able to move forward because their interests are aligned longer term.
Yeah, also I think if you look at defense industrial cooperation within the Australia-Japan relationship, it's only one part of that relationship. If you look at exercises, for example, I think you wrote a piece on that recently, which is the Japanese participation in Talisman Sabre, the US-Australia exercise, which was the first time that it happened last year, a very significant development within Australia-Japan relations, as well as US-Japan-Australia relations more broadly. I also wanted to get to the fact that, I mean, we also emphasize this point. This is only a single deal. There are other projects that Japan could potentially be involved in the defense and the naval realm more generally. And this is particularly important in the context of what Japan has been doing domestically in terms of some of the defense changes that we've seen under the Abe administration. There's talk about potentially Japan and India cooperating on some form of submarine technology. India's expressed interest in that. And Japan has also signed an agreement on defense equipment and transfer with the Philippines, something that all three of us have written about significantly. So there could be additional opportunities for Japan, not on submarine technology, but on various aerial and naval opportunities there. So I wanted to ask France in particular what you think there might be the potential for other Japanese projects, not just in terms of submarines, but also defense deals more generally.
Yes, so I think you touched upon this already a little bit, and I think rather than focusing on large ticket items, I think the focus for Japan will be more on exporting smaller niche components, such as, for example, missile tracking sensors, very particular specific submarine technology to other countries, rather than actual complete platforms such as submarines or aircraft. I mean, Indonesia, Taiwan, Vietnam, the United Kingdom all have expressed interest in Japanese military hardware over the last couple of years. But as of now, with the loss now of the submarine contract in Australia, the possible sale of amphibious search and rescue aircraft to India remains Japan's only tangible defense deal on the table as of now. I don't think, for example, that the offer of Kawasaki P-1 maritime patrol aircraft to Great Britain will be successful, just because I think the United Kingdom will be more likely to pick the Boeing P-8A Poseidon sub-hunting jet over the Japanese plane. Also, I think generally for some of those countries in Southeast Asia, and that's something I think we have to take into account, Japanese military hardware will just be too expensive. I think they're more likely to choose other suppliers. And I think overall, I think the failed bidding process in Australia was an important lesson for Japan, because I think its defense industry apparently still has a long way to go after lifting the self-imposed weapons export ban to become a major player in the global arms market.
Yeah, and Franz, I think you hit on a really interesting and valid point, I think, which is that Japan will have to focus on those small and specialized exports first to build up its just build up its comfort with exporting, simply because it hasn't done so for so many years. And I guess in hindsight, there was always something very strange about this Soryu bid for this historically large defense bid in the multiple billions of dollars for Australia. I mean, Japan really has no experience exporting anything like this for several years, and I guess the Australians were also aware of that. I mean, there is sort of this chicken and the egg problem for Japan, right? The Australians were concerned about Japan being able to deliver on this if awarded the contract, but how do they know that Japan can do that until it's actually received a contract and shown that it can deliver on its commitments? Anyways, I'm afraid that we'll have to wrap this up, but for listeners, we have had a lot of analysis of the Collins class replacement project at the Diplomat, and there will be a lot going forward. As Franz said, this was about to enter the contract phase, and we'll likely learn more details about the DCNS offering and the short fin Barracuda over the coming months. So definitely stay tuned for that at the Diplomat. And don't forget to subscribe on iTunes so you don't miss out on future episodes. Thanks for listening.